Upasakas and Upasikas. When you first heard the title of this lecture, or when perhaps you first read it in your copy of the April Shabda, you might have wondered why, I almost said why on earth, I'd happened to choose this particular subject on which to speak tonight, going for refuge. It isn't, of course, that the subject isn't appropriate. The subject is very appropriate indeed. One might even say, at a convention of order members, what subject could there be more appropriate than going for refuge? Because, after all, it's because we've gone for refuge. It's because we do go for refuge, shall go for refuge, that we're here on this occasion at all. But we have heard quite a lot about this subject before. And the human mind is such that it delights in variety and change. Variety, we are told, is the spice of life, and no doubt it's the spice of conventions too. You might have thought that you know already very well what going for refuge means. After all, you know about it not just from books, not just from hearsay, you know about it, to some extent at least, from your own practical experience. So the thought might have crossed your minds that it wasn't really necessary for Bhante to go over this same old ground again. You might even have thought that perhaps he was stuck for a lecture and was producing an old one to fill the gap. Now, it's true that there's no need, you know, to go over the same old ground again, even though reminders are always useful, especially reminders about so important a subject as going for refuge. However, let me assure you, I'm not going over the same old ground tonight, however justified I might have been in so doing. I'm going to speak tonight about an aspect of going for refuge, about which I've more recently been thinking quite a lot, turning over in my mind quite a lot, but about which I've so far not communicated, so far as I recollect, anything to anybody. I've certainly not mentioned this particular aspect in the course of any lecture, not even in the course of any book review. And the title of the talk should really be not so much just going for refuge in a more general sort of way, it should really be something more like levels of going for refuge, because it's about the levels of going for refuge that I'm going to talk. In fact, it's going to be a talk rather than a lecture, and it may be quite short. I shall also have something to say in connection with the third of the different levels of going for refuge. I shall also have something to say about the three so-called esoteric refuges. But first, by way of sort of winding into the main body of the talk, let me indulge in a few personal reminiscences. Reminiscences of one kind or another of my own experience of going for refuge. That is to say, my own experience of going for refuge in the more formal sense, that is to say, in the sense of reciting the words of the three refuges and the five or ten precepts in Pali. Either reciting them after somebody and myself taking them, or myself reciting them and somebody repeating them after me and therefore myself giving them. So my first reminiscence, this goes back quite a long way. And I must confess that the reminiscence isn't very clear. It's distinctly hazy, as one's reminiscences sometimes are. Just a few things, just a few points, almost like a few points of colour, stand out. And in this reminiscence, I'm in England. It's before I went out to India. And I'm in central London, and I'm in a hotel in the, I'm not quite sure, it might be the Victoria area, it might be the Bloomsbury area, but one of those two. In a room, a fairly large room, not quite as large as this, in a hotel. And the year is 1943 or 1944, I haven't been able quite to work it out, but it's definitely either one of those years. And in my reminiscence, I sort of see, in this room, in the hotel, a short, fat, dark, little man, with rather thick, sort of horn-rimmed spectacles, and he's wearing orange robes. There, this part of the reminiscence stops. I can't get any further. I'm not sure what he's doing. I'm not sure what he's saying. But I have another recollection. I have a recollection that as I entered this room in the hotel, as we entered the room, we were handed little cards, little white cards, which were called pencil cards. In other words, Panchasila cards, because on these little cards there were printed the refuges and the precepts in Pali. And I have a reminiscence that on this occasion, we recited the refuges and the precepts, reading from these little cards. I can't remember how many of us there were. I'm very hazy about the occasion. It was probably a Wesak celebration. I can't really account for the fact that it all made, you know, so little impression on me in a way. But one thing I do remember, one thing, you know, stood out quite sharply, and I still remember this. That was, I was looking at this card and I was seeing the Pali words, yeah? Which we pronounce as Dutiyampi, Tatiyampi. And as I read them, not knowing anything of Pali, it didn't seem that they sound at all like that. It was like more like Dutiyampi or Tatiyampi or something like that. And I heard them pronounced Dutiyampi, Tatiyampi, and this really struck me. I suppose it's my literary turn of mind. So that I remember. This is all part of this same reminiscence. So we recited the refuges and we recited the precepts. But I remember that there was no attempt on this occasion to explain the meaning of what we did. There was this short, fat, plump little man in the orange robes. There were all these people, and we had our pencil cards, and we were repeating, reciting refuges, precepts, with perfect Pali pronunciation, apparently. But there was no attempt on anybody's part to explain what we were doing and what it all meant and what it all signified. Apparently holding, you know, little pencil cards and reciting from them in this way were just something that Buddhists did. And looking back, you know, at that particular experience, you know, entertaining this particular reminiscence, it strikes me now as rather odd that at that time it didn't, as far as I remember, really occur to me to wonder why it was that so little, in fact, you know, hardly anything, was explained, certainly not the meaning of what we were doing when we chanted those Pali words, and chokas, I suppose one can say, the refuges and precepts. So that's my first reminiscence, rather vague and rather unsatisfactory from a strict Buddhist point of view, you must admit. And then, second reminiscence. Well, this time we're in India. It's some years later. The scene of the reminiscence is a vihara, a little vihara, sort of monastery come temple, in a place called Kusinara, in northeastern India. In other words, it's the place where, centuries upon centuries earlier, the Buddha had attained what Buddhists call parinirvana. And of course, I'm there. I'm sort of crouched, in a sort of squatting position in front of a very old monk with my elbows on my knees and my hands together like this. And I'm repeating the refuges and the 10 Shramanera precepts after this old monk. And I'm being ordained as a Shramanera. I'm wearing real orange robes. And the old monk is very insistent about my getting the correct pronunciation of the refuges. At this ordination ceremony, one has to repeat them both according to the Pali and according to the Sanskrit pronunciation. I won't go into the reason for all that now. So I was finding it quite difficult. I was having great difficulty with my aspirated consonants, I remember. I couldn't say Budhang, as I can now. I was saying Budhang. And I was saying Dhammang. And the old monk was saying, no, it's Dhammang. It's Dhammang. So he was coaching me, and I was just wanting to get ordained as a Samanera, and here I was having a lesson in Pali and Sanskrit phonetics in the course of the ceremony. And he was saying it must be Saranang. It's not Saranang, it's Saranang. So I was having great difficulty, but anyway, he coached me, and eventually I got it absolutely correct. Every sound, every aspirated consonant, every nasalization, every nasal N. Absolutely correct, and he was satisfied, and I was ordained. But there was no explanation on that occasion of what going for refuge really meant. I had this thorough, not to say wonderful, lesson in Pali and Sanskrit phonetics, but the significance, the import of what I was actually doing, the importance of the step I was taking, basically, from a spiritual point of view, was not explained. I must admit, in justice, the precepts were explained, what it meant to abstain from violence, what it meant not to take, to not given. This was all explained. But the real significance of the going for refuge was not explained at all on this occasion, when I became a Samanera. I just had a vague, though still quite strong sense that I've arrived, that I joined the Buddhist community, that I was now, as it were, a member of it. So that's my second reminiscence. So third reminiscence. Another vihara, a very small one, somewhere in Nepal. Some weeks later, I'm sitting in this vihara, near the shrine, near the image, and around me, kneeling on the floor, are several dozen Nepalese, that is to say Newar, Buddhists, mostly women. And they've come to the vihara for a special purpose. They ask to be given, as it's called, the refuges and the precepts. But being a very new Shramanera, I'd never had the opportunity of giving anybody the refuges and the precepts before, and I didn't know what to do. So I had to ask them. I had to learn how to do it. But I recited it, and then they recited it after me, and I gave a blessing at the end, and the little sermon, I suppose I have to call it, Epistle Discourse. I had to learn all this, and I did it. And these good people, these good ladies mostly, used to come along every morning, all the time that I was there, in that little vihara, and they take the refuges and precepts. And this made them very, very happy. Because in a way they knew the meaning of it, that Bhutang Saranang Gacchami meant to the Buddha for refuge I go. They knew so much that Dhammang Saranang Gacchami meant to the Dharma for refuge I go. They knew this. They knew what the meaning of the words was. But they clearly didn't think about it too much. They didn't understand, or they didn't want to understand, the real significance. What it really meant to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. They were perfectly happy just to recite the holy words after me and leave it at that. The recitation showed that they were Buddhists, that they belonged to the Buddhist community, that they were Newars, that they were tradespeople, that they belonged to a Buddhist social group, that they were not Hindus or Muslims or anything like that. They were Buddhists. So this was my third reminiscence. This is my third reminiscence. Now, my fourth reminiscence is, I must confess, a sort of non-reminiscence. I suppose I ought to remember reciting the refuges and precepts, but especially the refuges, at the time of my ordination as a bhikshu, which came about 2 years later in 1950. But I must confess, I've no such recollection whatever. I suppose I did recite the refuges on the occasion of my bhikshu ordination, but they must have made no impression at all on me. And that means that they could not have been considered at the time very important. And this is a very significant fact, as we shall see later on. So my fourth reminiscence, I'm sorry to say, is a non-reminiscence. All right, reminiscence number five. Reminiscence number five is not just one reminiscence, it's a whole group of reminiscences, extending over a period of several years, and embracing all sorts of places in many different parts of India. And especially this reminiscence embraces hundreds upon hundreds of meetings, public meetings, Buddhist meetings, many of them with thousands of people present. And most of these meetings were held, rather reluctantly so far as I was concerned, quite late at night. And they were held mostly in the open air, sometimes with a cold wind cutting through the place. And at these meetings, these late night open air meetings, I was called upon, sometimes at 1 o'clock, sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, after I had a cup of tea to keep myself awake, called upon to give the refuges and precepts to thousands of ex-untouchable, I was going to say Buddhists, but they just became Buddhists at that moment, ex-untouchable Mahars, mostly of Maharashtra. And in this way, they were converted, so to speak, to Buddhism. By this time, of course, here we've come to, say, the late 50s, early 60s. By this time, I had some idea of my own as to what going for refuge really meant. But nobody had ever told me. I'd worked it out for myself, more or less, with some help from some, at least, of the ancient Buddhist texts. And in the course of the talk which I used to give in these big, late at night, open air meetings, where all these ex-untouchables were converted to Buddhism, where they were given the refuges and precepts, in the course of my talk, I used to try to explain to these new Buddhists what the going for refuge really meant, what it meant to be a Buddhist. And usually, though it was late, and though they were tired, though they'd been working hard all day, they used to listen quite patiently and to try to understand. But one could see that quite a lot of them were not really interested in understanding what going for refuge really meant in the deeper and more fundamental sense. So far as they were concerned, going for refuge or conversion to Buddhism meant simply, at least to begin with, getting out of the clutches of orthodox Hinduism. It meant escape from the iniquities, one might say, of the Hindu caste system, at the very bottom of which, of course, they were oppressed by everybody else. And I must say, after having had quite a bit of contact with these people, having seen the way in which they used to live, the way in which they were treated by the orthodox Hindus, the caste Hindus, I can't blame them at all for wanting to use Buddhism in this way, and even seeing conversion to Buddhism in this way. But clearly, that wasn't enough. All right, sixth and last reminiscence. We're moving on rather rapidly, you notice. I'm back in London now, after 20 years in India. And it's 1964. And believe it or not, it's Wesak Day. Huh? Not very long after my return. And the scene is a scene with which some of you might be familiar. It's the Caxton Hall, Westminster. And there is Bhante on the platform with Mr. Christmas Humphreys and other British Buddhist dignitaries whose names I've forgotten. And at a certain stage of the proceedings, and Wesak celebrations of that sort in those days used to last exactly an hour, not a minute longer. At a certain stage in the proceedings, I was asked to recite Pensil, that is to say, the refuges and precepts. And when I say recite, I mean recite. I was not asked to lead it. I was asked to recite it. The idea being that we should all recite it together, that nobody should give it to anybody else. And I gathered that at the bottom of this rather strange practice, there was some sort of pseudo-democratic or pseudo-egalitarian idea. So I raised some feeble objection, and I pointed out that this wasn't the custom in Buddhist countries. In Buddhist countries, the bhikkhu or whoever else officiated led in the recitation of the precepts, and others repeated after him, and this produced a rather pleasant antiphonal kind of effect. But this didn't go down at all well. My objections were brushed aside, and Mr. Christmas Humphreys said, "We've done it this way for 40 years and we're not going to change now." So I just recited, and the people present, there must have been up to 100 people, they tried to recite with me. They came straggling along, in fact, rather in the rear. Very few of them actually knew the refuges and precepts by heart, and on this occasion, I don't know why, there were no pencil cards. So the results were not very good. The results were rather ragged, to say the least. In fact, to tell the truth, the results were quite appalling. And I realised, if I hadn't realised it before, having been by that time some months in England, that something was seriously wrong with British Buddhism.